We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support. You are listening to Pop Torah with Rabbi Znopf and Olitsky, a JCast Network podcast. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts, please visit jcastnetwork.org.
Welcome to Pop Torah, the podcast where we look at pop culture from a Jewish perspective and look at Judaism through the lens of pop culture. As always, we are your hosts. I'm Rabbi Michael Knopf.
And I am Rabbi Jesse Olitsky.
And we've got our tuxes on. We've got our ball gowns on.
We are walking
the red carpet. Red carpet this year, not a champagne carpet. We're done with that noise. We are here for the Oscars 2024. This is not an Oscars preview episode, an Oscars recap episode. Jesse, tell us about the Oscars this year. The 96th Annual Academy Awards, was it?
Yes, the 96th Annual Academy Awards took place on March 10th, just after our recording of this episode with Jimmy Kimmel as host. I thought Jimmy Kimmel did a great job as host. I actually thought John Mulvaney, for what it's worth, right? That's his name, right?
Mulaney.
John Mulaney.
You're confusing him with the former chief of staff of President Trump's.
John Mulaney, I think he should be in line to host next year. His bits were hilarious. Highlight of the night for me was the I'm Just Ken musical performance, personally.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought Jimmy Kimmel was a great host. I want to go over some of the top winners. I will stay from the outset that if we really just want to talk about the top winners, then we should be talking about Oppenheimer again, which we talked in great detail, great length about, because Oppenheimer really cleaned up at the Oscars with seven winners, seven awards, including Best Picture, including Cillian Murphy as Best Actor, including Best Director of Christopher Nolan, including Best Supporting Actor Robert Downey Jr., all of which I thought was, you know, well deserved. But I wanted to go through the Best Picture nominees and see if they got it right with Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, we talked about, was, you know, a 3+ hour movie. I thought the second half of the movie was much more meaningful and entertaining for me than the first half. The Holdovers, which we talked about. American Fiction, which was a great movie. Highly recommend. Barbie, which we talked about. Past Lives, I saw on a recent flight. I was totally moved by it. Past Lives is a movie which talks about a Nora, who is a South Korean immigrant to North America. And she immigrates to North America as a child. And it takes place then as a young adult, as an adult in her early 20s in New York City. And she reconnects with her childhood best friend, who was her first crush, and talks about their differences. They reconnect, right? This is the early 2000s on Skype, which is great because nobody used Zoom then. We all use Skype for video connection. And then it goes 12 years after that when she is married to, you know, a Jewish writer living in the Lower East Side in the Village in New York City. And then meets this person, Haesung, for the first time since she was 8 years old and left South Korea. And this idea of past lives, right? It's this idea that sometimes we think we're destined to be together. And maybe at any time we even touch or graze another person, it must mean that we had a relationship in a past life, according to Korean, but also Buddhist ideas. And it was the idea that this person who she thought was, for lack of a better term, her Besheret, maybe in a past life, they were together, but she's in a relationship with Arthur, right? She's married to Arthur, this Jewish man, because she herself is totally different. She is not her Korean self, but she is her Korean American self as an immigrant. And it, I think, is a deeply meaningful immigrant story, a story about how her life has really different as a Korean immigrant than somebody who continued to live in South Korea and served in the military and went to university and is making a career in South Korea. Maestro, we did not talk about, but Maestro, quite Jewish, not just because it is a movie that Spielberg was involved in, but because Bradley Cooper played Leonard Bernstein, there's a much debate about whether or not somebody who is not Jewish should be playing somebody who's Jewish. There is much debate about the prosthetic nose he wore and what does it mean about a Jewish depiction or a Jewish caricature. Anatomy of a Fall.
Yes, there was talk of coining a new term, which I think has not happened yet or has not caught on yet. You know, is akin to blackface being Jewface.
Yes.
I think that's a stop trying to make fetch happen kind of situation. But
fair enough. Anatomy of a Fall.
New Mean Girls not nominated.
I know. I did.
Well,
see
no,
it.
that came out in 24, didn't it?
It did, but it's also okay, now out to stream on Paramount Plus.
Not eligible. Maybe next year.
Anatomy of a Fall is a French film about a woman who's suspected of her husband's death and dealing with their son who is visually impaired and the moral dilemma because he's the main witness but doesn't necessarily see accurately or everything. Killers of the Flower Moon, which I have to say I was very surprised that Lily Gladstone did not win Best Actress for Killers of the Flower Moon because she cleaned up in the awards season for Best Actress. Emma Stone did win her second Academy Award. She is only the second actress to win two Best Actress awards by the age of 35. She also won for La La Land, the other being Hilary Swank, who won for Boys on the Side and Million Dollar Baby. And we have...
Boys Don't Cry, not Boys on the Side.
Boys Don't Cry. What's Boys on the Side?
That was a Drew Barrymore, like, rom-com kind of thing. Or it was kind of like an updated Thelma and Louise. I don't remember.
All right, Boys Don't Cry.
I never saw it, but it's sort of like girl power, women friendship movie.
Yeah,
anyway.
She didn't win for that. Killers of the Flower Moon.
Let's hear it for the boys.
Mike and I both tried to watch Killers of the Flower Moon, like a typical Martin Scorsese film. It was, to me, at least, it was way too long, and I couldn't get through it. I started and stopped several times. The idea and the storyline was fascinating, deeply heart-wrenching, but to me, it was just too long. The Zone of Interest. Zone of Interest is a fascinating story. Also something worth us digging into. It's an international film and actually won the Academy Award for Best International Film, which we'll talk more about that based on a comment that the writer and director, Jonathan Glazer, said. But it's a story about a Nazi soldier who's trying to, build this beautiful life in his house with a garden and raising his children in a home that is next to Auschwitz, right next to the concentration camp. I remember thinking, Mike and I went on USY Israel Pilgrimage Poland seminar together in the summer of 2000. And
group
I remember when we were walking through Majdanek together. Majdanek is the one camp, which they say is so intact, not a museum like Auschwitz or something like that, but so intact that within 48 hours, God forbid, it could be still operational as a concentration camp. And you see these high-rise apartments overlooking Majdanek, overlooking where there's the smokestacks of the ashes of human bodies that were burned and cremated. And you can't help but think, what were they looking at when they were living in their luxury apartments, sitting on their balconies at night, sipping wine? What were they looking at? And that's really what's, some of what this story deals with.
You could see it in Auschwitz itself. The town, is surrounding the camp, both, all parts of Auschwitz. It's just really a provocative concept for a film, because you go to these places and you can see it, right? You mentioned Majdanek also, like that's what Hannah Arendt, you know, would have called the banality of evil. That we are often willing to tolerate, overlook, look past horrors when they don't, you know, impact us directly, and just go on and live our lives. And so really, that was the theme of Zone of Interest.
Absolutely. And then finally, Poor Things, now streaming on Hulu. I recently watched it. It was one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen. Some people loved it. Maybe it just wasn't for me. Some of it was dramatic. Some of it was dark comedy. I thought Mark Ruffalo's accent in it was terrible. It was way too... It was way more sexually explicit than I was prepared for. There was a lot of Emma Stone nude having sex, because the storyline is of weird storyline of like Willem Dafoe as an experimental, almost Frankenstein-like surgeon who takes the corpse of Emma Stone and puts a baby's brain into it to bring her back to life. And so she was basically an adult in a child's body.
A child in an adult's body.
Sorry, yes, an adult's body, but with a child's brain, yes. Yeah. And she is experiencing, you know, pleasure and life and instinct as a child, but is that of a young woman? I thought it was super weird, but I guess some people liked it. But Emma Stone did a good job, but the movie was super weird. And then we had cleaning up in the categories. Cillian Murphy won Best Actor for Oppenheimer. Emma Stone, as I said, won Best Actress for Poor Things. Divine Joy Randolph, we praised her when we talked about the holdovers, won Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers, and Robert Downey Jr. won Best Supporting Actor for Oppenheimer. Not for Iron Man, but for Oppenheimer. Right.
Well, listen, I think that what you're getting at here is that, the Pop Torah bump is a real thing. Oppenheimer walks away with it. It got the Pop Torah bump. Some of these films that were nominated for Best Picture, we did not cover. The ones we did not cover did not enjoy the Pop Torah bump.
That's true.
We did not have episodes on any of the movies where there were nominees for Best Actress. So, you know, who knows what would have happened if we had talked about Killers of the Flower Moon? Maybe Lily Gladstone would have won. There was a battle.
You know, when people thank the members of the Academy, they're basically saying thank you, Jesse and Mike.
That's right. I mean, Divine Joy Randolph definitely got the Pop Torah bump. Listen, yeah.
She said God is good. She listens to our Torah.
Right. Right. Let's talk about the Best Actress race, and we can talk about Poor Things and Killers of the Flower Moon first in doing that. So we didn't cover any of these movies in previous episodes of Pop Torah. Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone were kind of, in a horse race all awards season for who was going to walk away with it. What's interesting, I felt differently about Poor Things than you did. I mean, but I didn't, I agree with you. Weird, darkly comic, dramatic. Roger Ebert once said that the Oscar for best acting is really often the Oscar for most acting. And I think that that's true in this case. Emma Stone did more acting than Lily Gladstone in a sense. Obviously, Lily Gladstone's performance was meant to be understated, was meant to be more stoic. I honestly was surprised that Lily Gladstone was in contention for Best Actress to begin with in a lead role, because her role in a lot of ways in Killers of the Flower Moon wasn't really a lead role.
Supporting,
it was a supporting role. The lead roles, you know, Robert De Niro's role was a lead role. Leonardo DiCaprio's role was a lead role. Maybe, I don't know, it's arguable. It was really an ensemble kind of movie. There wasn't really one lead, one protagonist. In a way, even though Robert De Niro's character arguably is the one sort of that looms over the movie. I thought Lily Gladstone's performance was really understated and strong. But if I were an Academy voter, other than the fact that it would have made an important a political statement and historical statement to make Lily Gladstone the first Native American woman to win Best Actress. She was the first Native American woman to be nominated for Best Actress. I think that I would have preferred, I think like just evaluating performances themselves, I think Emma Stone's performance was a stronger performance. She really, it certainly was a lead performance in a classical way. She, you know, the movie
was about her. About Bella Baxter.
Right. So the movie wouldn't have been what it was without Emma Stone's performance there. And I thought it was really good. She kind of runs, you really see an extraordinary range that she has, you know, going from, and it's very subtle throughout, right? She starts as an infant, basically, right? In the movie, and she kind of grows to a young woman. And you kind of see that it's very subtle, the progression and the trajectory as she's learning the world and learning life. You know, I liked Poor Things. I think what you're pointing to also, Jesse, and this is also true for Killers of the Flower Moon, is how we watch movies nowadays. I wonder if I would have felt differently about Killers of the Flower Moon if I had seen it in theaters versus watching it streaming on, I guess, Netflix or wherever it was streaming, that I watched it, where I was Apple TV Plus, where I was able to watch it in chunks, right? I was like, okay, this is a 3-hour movie. I can't devote 3 hours to it. Three plus hour movie. So I'm going to do what I did with The Irishman, Scorsese's last film, which is like, you know, I'm going to watch an hour here, an hour there, an hour there.
The older he gets, the longer his movies get.
which I think is not an optimal way of watching these movies. I do think that, you know, what if Martin Scorsese had made Killers of the Flower Moon a limited series? Like, I think it would have been better. Same thing with The Irishman. I think it would have been better.
You know, I wonder if directors need to adapt the way they make their movies based on how we watch movies. I will say Oppenheimer, I did watch in the theater. And then I watched it again. My wife didn't see it in the theater. And then when it came out on streaming on Peacock, we watched it again. It felt much longer sitting on my couch than it did in the theater, right?
Yeah,
that's the difference with the streaming experience.
And
the theater experience. Right.
Oppenheimer is long, but I saw it in the theater and I was riveted by it, right? I did not look at my watch once. That's usually my evaluation of, you know, how engrossing movie is, you know, however long it is. You know, Oppenheimer really captivated me, you know, from start to finish. It's possible that Killers of the Flower Moon would have been like that too had I seen it in the theaters. But at the same time, you know, I don't know if I would have like paid $15 a ticket plus babysitting costs, et cetera, to go see Poor Things in the theater. But I'm glad I saw it. I think it was a really interesting and provocative movie with a great performance by Emma Stone. If it had walked away with Best Picture, I think I would have said, you know, that was it didn't deserve it in the way Oppenheimer did. I think Oppenheimer was the right pick for Best Picture there, at least of the ones I saw. In disclosure, I have not seen probably about half of the Best Picture nominees. I haven't seen Zone of Interest yet, Anatomy of a Fall yet, American Fiction yet, Past Lives or Maestro. So essentially half of the Best Picture nominees I didn't get a chance to see yet this year. Hopefully I'll be able to.
But that's why they didn't win, because Top Tour.
That's why they didn't get the
them.
Bump. Yeah. I think that there's certainly, I mean, there were a couple of themes, I think that, you know, that really kind of came up. Certainly the big winners of the night, if you, you know, think of it, were Oppenheimer, or the dominant movies for the night, the ones that kind of loomed large, even though Barbie loomed large in a different way, didn't end up really walking away with any awards except for Best Original Song for Billie Eilish and Phineas for What Was I Made For? Although I'm Just Ken, you're right, was an amazing highlight of, I thought, a really great telecast too. I thought Jimmy Kimmel did a great job. The evening moved. I liked the style of presenting the best acting nominees with previous winners as, you know, giving nice sharing nice words about their colleagues and maybe friends at times. I thought that was really generally speaking very like well done and sweet. I like when the awards kind of lean into their sense of legacy and professional recognition. I instead of pandering to the audience at home, I like that. I think that's what these people put in a lot of really hard work, and they should be given their due. So I liked that. I thought that some of the comic bits, like you mentioned, I'm Just Ken was great. John Cena presenting best costumes naked was hilarious. And I thought that the bit with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito
and Michael Keaton,
and Michael Keaton was
even
just,
though even though Arnold Schwarzenegger actually fought George Clooney, not Michael.
Yes, Keaton. That's right. I think that is a separate conversation we need to have about whether Batman and Robin is canon in the Tim Burton Batman universe. But I think that what loomed large over the ceremony, were Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and Zone of Interest. And I think Oppenheimer and Zone of Interest for sure share some commonalities. So when Cillian Murphy accepted his award, he said, I made this movie about someone who's responsible for a lot of disaster and bloodshed. Unleashed something in the world that has enormous disastrous potential. And so I'm going to dedicate this award to the peacemakers. When Jonathan Glazer accepted his award for Zone of Interest, he articulated what he felt his movie was in a sense really about, which is about our propensity for dehumanizing other people and committing atrocities or allowing atrocities to unfold because of our willingness to dehumanize other people. And even Poor Things in a way is related to that. I mean, there was sort of like a violence that kind of underrode the movie. Willem Dafoe's experimentations on himself, the experimentations of his father on him. The idea of creating something, it's sort of like a Frankenstein, right? It's sort of Oppenheimer-ish, right? It's you do this experiment because you think it's an interesting scientific thing, but then you can't really control it afterwards, or the harm it might unleash to other people or to itself. Obviously Mark Ruffalo's character is supposed to be a foil in that, but how he's impacted by Bella. And how he ends up calling her a monster and all these things, right? It does have that a similar idea of what we through human ingenuity have the capacity to unleash the harm we have the capacity to inflict. Sorry, Jesse, I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say the idea of using film to talk about human experience and to talk about how we are at fault and responsible for our relationship with others, right? I actually think that's why Poor Things was personally not a serious candidate for Best Picture, because it was so silly in telling that story. I also think that's why Barbie, even though it was a social commentary, wasn't a serious candidate because of the silly nature. And I don't mean that in a you know, sort of derogatory sense, but the silly nature in which it's got its message across. I do agree with you that there is a sort of a judging of humanity. We see it in The Holdovers, how Paul Giamatti's character is judged by the students, and we come to understand and appreciate him. We see it in Zone of Interest, right? Where you have the balance of a Nazi, like an SS soldier, a commander who is trying to create life for his family, and the balance that we, the viewer, knows the atrocities that the Nazi did to the Jews, and how try to sort of contextualize, sit with the everyday life experiences that he's trying to provide for his family and for his children. I want to bring up, if it's okay.
Can I just, before you change gears a bit, just to note, right? And we talked about this when we talked about The Holdovers, that the presence of war and who fights war, who's spared from war, is present in The Holdovers too. So I think that's worth noting, as well as, you know, Killers of the Flower Moon is really about oppression and exploitation, and, you know, our propensity to, you know, want to benefit ourselves, even if it's at the expense of other people. In this case, it was, you know, actively murdering systematically Native peoples in order to inherit their oil money. But I think it, you know, what makes it powerful is not only, you know, what it points out about the violence of white supremacy in American history, but also, you know, what that says about the human condition altogether. That is, you know, again, you know, a similar theme that you see in Zone of Interest in Oppenheimer as well, is that, you know, we can do these things if we have enough resources and power. We can make them happen, and we tend to, you know, justify the outcomes or the results because they benefit us, even if they are actually monstrous. Sure. And so I think that is, you know, a sort of a moral and ethical theme, a Jewish theme that's worthy of consideration, that is, you know, very present in a lot of these films.
Can we talk about Zone of Interest for a second? Sure. The Zone of Interest, and specifically Jonathan Glazer, the writer and director's comments in his acceptance speech when the film won Best International Film at the Academy Awards.
Sure.
He said, I want to make sure that I am quoting correctly. He said that he stood there along with the producers as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether the victims of October 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack in Gaza. He was criticized by the Anti-Defamation League. He was actually criticized by the Holocaust Survivors Foundation. I'm wondering your thoughts on his using, clearly he is using his platform to take a stance and be critical of Israel's current war in Gaza against Hamas. I'm wondering your thoughts on such a comment and using the Holocaust as an analogy, if you will, or an excuse for war and bloodshed elsewhere in our history.
Yeah. So I think that, first of all, I think that there, you know, we're kind of two categories of takes, at least in the Jewish world, that I saw after this. You know, one is people who I think legitimately misunderstood what he was saying, because it was sort of like inelegantly phrased and somewhat like rushed through in a way, right? So I think that like
although he wasn't speaking off the cuff, right? He was reading remarks that he had written in advance.
Correct. But I think that that there was some punctuation there that didn't come across in how he read it. So I think that, first of all, he was not disavowing his own Jewishness or refuting his own Jewishness. I think that he's saying that he is a man who refutes Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked for a particular political purpose. And so I think that there is a category of people who just legitimately misunderstood him.
Sure.
And then there are people who are like, I think, deliberately misunderstanding him, including the fact that I don't think that he's necessarily analogizing what's happening in Gaza to the Holocaust. I think he is saying, and I think that this is a fair point, the global Jewish community and the state of Israel often points to the Holocaust as a justification, and sometimes in some ways rightly, the Holocaust as a justification for Israel's existence and Jewish right to self-determination and self-defense, that also therefore justifies any and every action that leads toward that end, right? So in other words, like the end of Jewish self-determination and self-defense is sufficiently justifiable or is a sufficient moral good to justify any actions taken to ensure that moral end. And I listen, regardless of what I might think about Jonathan Glazer's point, I think that point is a fair one, because it is something that happens all the time in the Jewish community and in Israel, right? We often say, like, we do what we do. We are standing for what we stand for. We are fighting for what we're fighting for because of never again.
Yes, right? except his, I agree with you, maybe there should have been punctuation. So it's not that he's refuting his Jewishness, but he's refuting that Jewishness and the Holocaust as being hijacked as an excuse, yada, yada, yada. My concern is, right, when he says being hijacked by an occupation, which has led to conflict for so many. What I wonder is, what is he really talking about, right? And this is where it gets difficult. And this is where the language we use, we have to be very careful. Is he speaking about an occupation since 1967? Is he speaking about a 75-year occupation, right? People use these words differently, right? Is breaking the silence, for what it's worth, right? The group, which you and I, when we were in Israel, we both went on Breaking the Silence trips to walk through Hebron with former IDF soldiers who served there, who talked about as veterans the mistreatments of Palestinians by soldiers when they were serving, right? And the disparity. We had a classmate who served in Israel with us, who was in Israel with us, who previously served in the IDF. And he talked about his own experiences serving in Hebron, his own experiences serving in Gaza. I get all that. The question is he talking about that the Holocaust is being hijacked for the sake for Israel to exist, right? That's a very different narrative than the Holocaust being hijacked as an excuse to justify Israel doing whatever they do. Because I think many Israelis, even during this war, right, overwhelming Israelis are critical of Netanyahu and its government and look forward to the day when Netanyahu can be removed from office. What I wonder, and this is the response from the Holocaust Survivors Foundation, is it's great that Jonathan Glazer is an artist who made a movie about the Holocaust. And I say this as somebody who have no family members who survived the Holocaust, but I don't mean that to say that I have family members who died, right? I don't, my family, I'm a fourth generation American. My great grandparents were from here, right? So my question is really that of the Holocaust Survivors Foundation. Does it give right somebody who is so far removed from the trauma of the Holocaust the right to criticize people's legitimate fear and PTSD from the Holocaust? I'm not equating the two by any means.
It's a really challenging question. You know, I've seen not just in the wake of the Oscars, but you know, repeatedly in recent months, arguments coming from you know, within the Jewish community that Holocaust analogies are never appropriate. And I find that to be a really untenable position to hold, because like the purpose, the stated purpose of, you know, creating all of the Holocaust museums and memorials that we've created was to ensure that, you know, such an atrocity would never happen again. And if that's if that's the premise, then we do believe that the Holocaust, you know, may be the first, and you know, the defining event of genocide, right? The concept didn't exist before the Holocaust. But it's not unique in an essential sense, that like there could be other Holocausts, maybe of Jews, maybe of other people. And what right. we need to learn are the lessons for like how that happened to make sure that it never happened again. So I just don't agree that, you know, Holocaust analogies are never appropriate. I think that sometimes Holocaust analogies can be appropriate, and we ought to think in those terms to ensure that something like the Holocaust never happens again to the Jewish people or to other people. But I think that the challenge of that is how not to so quickly jump to that traumatized place, such that it distorts our understanding of and our reaction to what's actually happening right now. So, you know, yes, the Jewish community, understandably, both in Israel and worldwide, understandably, has inherited trauma from the Holocaust and from a history of persecution. October 7th, in a lot of ways, and again, perfectly understandably so, and as somebody who was not living in Israel at the time, but who has family in Israel, third generation American, like I don't live the same realities as Israelis do. October 7th definitely opened up that wound and triggered that generational trauma. And I think it's indisputable that it did. And yet, October 7th was the circumstances around October 7th are not the same circumstances as the Jews of Europe on the eve of the Holocaust. And I find it really difficult when I hear within the Jewish community, arguments that tie it so closely to the Holocaust, and therefore say that our response ought to be what we would have done or wanted to have done to the Germans during the World War II, when the, you know, like Germany had a powerful standing army on the eve of World War II that was able to invade and conquer Poland and France and Czechoslovakia, right? All those things, right? The Hamas in Gaza does not have that capacity. So, you know, that happened like that's happened repeatedly, you know, I've heard people, you know, expressing, you know, sympathy for Gazan civilians who are dying or being displaced by Israel's bombardment, who, you know, people praying for peace for all who dwell in the land. And I've had people say to me, like, could you imagine a Jew praying for the well-being of German civilians during World War II? And my feeling about it is that these situations are not really analogous. But there is a sense in our mind, in our collective Jewish mind, that is trying to make them so. And I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, I don't think we're trying to make them so. I think when we do that, that is flawed. But I also think Jonathan Glazer's statement is flawed as well, and suggests that things are more black and white than they are, right? Saying that that using our Jewishness and the Holocaust to hijack, an occupation. Again, to be very careful what he's talking about, right? To me, it sounds like the existence of the state of Israel itself is how.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it would be nice to hear from him if that's what he meant, because you're right. The occupation gets utilized in different ways in different circles. For some, occupation means the territory Israel captured and has occupied. Or had military control over, and some senses settled in post 67, and Green Line Israel,
right.
which some people mean by occupation. I'm not sure which one he meant. I would have a disagreement with him if he meant the latter.
Sure.
I may disagree with the premise of hijacking Jewishness and the Holocaust to justify the occupation, even if he means the former. But I think that there's a way in which I think that that he has a point to make there.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just not sure, right? You have 30 seconds to make a speech. I wish he would have used his 30 seconds differently to be more eloquent in what he was trying to say, because I think he got it wrong, right? That the difference between now, then yes, we could talk about, occupation if we want to talk about the occupied territories. But there's a sovereign Jewish state with an Israeli army that did not exist during World War II. I'm not saying that if there was, the Holocaust wouldn't happen or anything like that, although I think certainly that would have been the case. But it's also not like to look at Hamas as sort of a militant terrorist group that doesn't have the capabilities of the Nazis, right? This is a group that is totally funded and supported by the Ayatollah, right? By Iran. So is Hezbollah. They are funded by the superpower in the region that wants to literally nuke Israel off the map. I think we just have to be careful to say, well, it's different. And I'm not saying that.
Well,
we
right, but
I'm not saying as Jews or as Israelis or as American Jews, we shouldn't care deeply about the lives of innocent Palestinians. We should. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that I think anytime somebody has 30 seconds and choose to use their platform to make a statement, they have to be very careful about what statement they're saying and what words they want to say, because it's quite easy for them to be taken out of context. Maybe he said exactly what he wanted to say. Maybe it's being taken out of context. But if he said exactly what he wanted to say, then I disagree with what he's saying. And I think it's hurtful to many survivors that a movie about the Holocaust, where the last generation of survivors is dying out, and it's our job now, right? Fourth generation American, it's my job to carry on the stories of the Holocaust. It's the National Holocaust Museum's job to carry on the stories of the Holocaust. That instead of focusing on that, he's focusing on Gaza. So he's actually doing the opposite. He's not talking about the importance of telling this story and teaching future generations the atrocities of our past.
Well, yeah, but why do we do that? Why do we teach future generations the atrocities of the past? I think that the point, and admittedly, I haven't seen the movie, but my sense is that the point of the movie was not about the atrocities of the past per se. It was about how we justify and permit atrocities like that to happen now, right? And I think that, again, I think this is worthy of a deeper conversation. Like, I think the basic point, I mean, the question at the core of what he said is, does Jewishness and the Holocaust the memory of the Holocaust and Jewishness get abused in order to justify actions that are just at maybe not just as but that are that are violent, oppressive, and dehumanizing in ways that are, you know, akin, even if distantly akin, to those atrocities. And I would say, yes, I think that basic point is, I think that basic point is a fair one. Now, you're right, words matter, especially in a platform where you're going to be watched by a billion people. And one of the cardinal rules of politics is, you know, when you're explaining, you're losing. Right. So the fact that like he now has to explain or should explain what he said means that he did not get across what he I think hoped to get across there. And it could cause a lot of damage. So I think that's certainly, you know, that's also, I think, you know, a Jewish lens of looking at what he said is that, you know, life and death are in the power of the tongue. Be very careful about what you say.
Well, I agree that this is something maybe for us to dig deeper in and have a more in-depth conversation. In the meantime, let us know what you thought of the 96th Annual Academy Awards, what you thought of the surprise winners and the snubs. And remember, if you want to win, then you need the Pop Torah bump next time. And until next time, I am Rabbi Jesse Olitsky.
And I am Rabbi Knuth. That was trying to be like Ken. No, I'm Michael Knuth.
Take care, everyone.